Hey, why don't we talk about some books?
Da-da-da-da-da.
Somebody should. I've been reading a lot of books. So I've been in my quest to read everything that's basically on my bookshelf. Or as much as I can, to clear up as much space as I can. So that when I move, I could have significantly fewer books. I kind of went a little Marie Kondo on it. But not full on, not balls out. I think we've all, you know, if you're not familiar, the life-saving magic of tidying up, life-changing magic. And you know, obviously it's not magic, right? It's a method to help you tidy that I think works. I think everyone's got their version of it that works for them. These kind of books, like I'm reading one right now about Swedish death cleaning. Which is, I guess, you know, the concept being, I guess it's customary in Sweden to sort of start cleaning up your possessions and things as you get older, so that when you die, you don't leave this huge mess of shit for your loved ones to take care of. Which I think the major flaw in that one is like, well, if you didn't have any loved ones, then fuck it, who cares? I mean, who's going to have to clean it up? I don't know, somebody. But presumably somebody who's getting paid, right? I don't know. But anyway, it's just kind of this another thing similar to the life-changing magic. And it's all basically the same idea, which is that, just get rid of shit you don't need. Or, you know, stuff that you don't need and stuff you don't want. I think that the important thing that, you know, these both do is like, hey, if something brings you joy, you can keep it. Like, it's not telling you. I don't like these ones where it's like, I'm so committed to minimalism that I don't keep anything around. You know what I mean? Like, I don't keep things in my home. And their house looks beautiful, but it's not where I would want to live. I mean, I'm like, I don't know, man. I like having a Nintendo. I like playing Nintendo and would like to have a Nintendo. Also, I don't have a bullshit job that involves going around and telling other people to be minimalist. So therefore, I do kind of need a wardrobe and things. I mean, this is what I don't like about sort of the general idea of minimalism, right? They'll be like, have as few clothes as possible. And it's like, that's not very realistic if you're somebody who, you know, one guy talked about how he basically has gone around the United States with just a backpack, you know, and he's like, well, if I need more clothes, I can buy them when I get there or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's not a great realistic way to live. Something is happening where we're not moving forwards right now, and I'm not sure what that something is, but it's really unfortunate. Would we all love to live the lifestyle of basically like, oh yeah, I just kind of go out and I have an amount of clothes, and then I will buy more clothes if I need them. That would be great. But we can't do that. That's not a look forward to a bowl lifestyle for all of us, to use the technical terminology. I'm just going to try going straight across this intersection and see if I can just keep driving off a cliff. So what's good about the death cleaning and the life saving da 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 is like, I think they're more realistic. They are a little bit more like, hey, if you like something, hang on to it. Like, you don't have to get rid of things that make you happy. The Marie Kondo one is like, hold something and see if it sparks joy. And I'm like, I don't know if I'd go that far. You know, hold something until you ejaculate. And then if that happens, then you're good. But it's still possible. And the death cleaning one is pretty similar. I mean, one of the things I liked about the life saving so on is, like how every time I say it, it gets shorter and I'm more annoyed. So I'm like, yeah, it's not a catchy title. Like, they should have just called it Kondo Marie or something. The Kondo Method. But I guess it doesn't sound. The title sounds really good and is very descriptive. But then when you're trying to recall the title, it's like the da 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 da, There was another book I read. It was like a novel that had like a similar title that I was getting so annoyed. Oh no, I was talking about the TV show Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Which I'm like, yeah, it's a good title because like it says what it is. What happens on that show? If someone asks you that question, they're a moron. Because you would look at them and be like, what do you think happens on that show, idiot? But it's kind of annoying to say. So the other day I'm watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Or, hey, I was watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and it's like, oh, God. All right, enough. Enough is enough. Enough is enough, isn't it? So anyway, one of the things I've been trying to do, though, is be like, well, I'll put these books in my brain, and then I won't have to carry them around. I mean, I've got quite a number of books that I've moved two or three times and still have not read. You know, so like, that pretty much tells you what you need to know about my involvement with them, right? I mean, if you've moved a book two or three times, then, and you haven't read it, it's probably time to shit or get off the pot, as it were. Or stay on the pot, but read the book while you're on there taking a dump, so you can get rid of it. And like, the way I've been doing it book-wise is trying to sort of just keep anything that is important to me as an object, you know what I mean, is the start. So like, you know, I have a copy of Survivor by Chuck Palahniuk, and I loaned it to some friends, and they made like notes and underlines in it, and I have some in there. And it was just this fun book that we passed around, and also it was kind of, I think, the book that got me like back into reading, really. So it's like an important, I like having that book. Like, that book is cool to have for me. You know, valuable books. I probably have like four of those. And when I say valuable, I mean worth like $50. But, you know, I like them enough, and they're of enough value that it's worth moving them around. I've got some comics because it's like, I think I'll want to reread them. I'm fairly sure. Like, I'm not a big rereader. So I've gotten rid of a lot of stuff that I would have kept for the sake of rereading, but don't really need. I've gotten some stuff scanned. I sent some books off to be scanned and put into PDF. I thought I should do this. I've kind of got this small library of stuff that I guess I would describe as my sort of, you know, in my imaginary world where I'm teaching like a creative writing class, these would be really helpful to me. So I should probably just send those off to get scanned. It's like, I want the material, but it's not like the experience of the book itself is important at all, right? So anyway, you know, and the other thing I've been doing is taking them and saying like, well, I do want to read this, I just never got around to it, and trying to be a little bit better about reading stuff that I've been meaning to read, you know, instead of putting other stuff in front. Like, I see something cool come through the library and I'm like, no, let's stick to the program. And also not reading four books at once. This is like a point of pride for some people, is like, I'm usually reading four or five books at once. But usually if I'm reading four or five books at once, what it means is I'm half reading four or five books that I'm not really enjoying and don't really want to pay attention to, if I'm honest with you. So, you know, I'm just trying to be a little more focused on one thing at a time. And get through the books that way, right? So that's pretty cool. That's a new venture for me. So what have I been reading? One of the books I just read was Under Major Domo Minor. As fun to read as it is to say. That's not true. I don't think anything's that fun, but it was pretty fun. It's by Patrick DeWitt. He's a guy who wrote The Sisters Brothers. He also wrote a book called Ablutions, A-B-L-U-T-I-O-N-S, which is awesome, because it's a really like heartfelt good book about a bunch of worthless drunks, and it's written in the second person, so it's like, you do this, you do that, and I think it's great because that doesn't usually work, and it totally works in this book. I mean, I was telling Poonmaster about how a lot of times people try stuff like that and it's like a gimmick and it gets so old by the end. It came up because Chuck was talking about Time's Arrow by Martin Amis or Amy or whatever. And so everything goes backwards in that book. And Chuck was like, but it's totally a cheat because, you know, at one point there's a guy and he feels this familiar emptiness in his stomach and then he goes back to the bathroom. And it's like, and I was waiting for him to be sitting on the toilet and a turd just like comes flying out of the pipe and then drills up into his insides and goes up, you know. But that doesn't happen. He just kind of goes into the bathroom and then comes back out. Total cheat. But, so, you know, gimmicks like that rarely work. But I think when they work really well, right? Because you're like, well, they pulled it off and it just works. I read a book once called The Interrogative Case, which was a book that was every sentence was a question and ended in a question mark. And I think like 3 pages in, I was exhausted and was just thinking, well, you know, I guess this is a brave experiment, but I mean, the book seems like it's garbage so far, and it's not. There are some things that are interesting because you can do them, but that doesn't mean they're worth reading. It's a little bit like, you know, the literary jacking off thing, where it's like, I mean, I get why you'd be interested in trying this and whatever, but I think you should have made this a 3-page short story where this works better and not a full-length novel where this doesn't really work. I hate to say it to you, but this doesn't really work because no one wants to read that. And, you know, there's the whole thing, right? You don't want to write for an audience or something necessarily, at least when you're starting out and when you're trying to do something new. But when you go to the publishing stage, you should be like, who's going to read this and why? And with that book, I'd be like, I don't know who's going to read this. And if someone was like, why do you think they would read this book? I'd be like, just to see if they could finish. Angry quest to finish something they'd started. That seems like the most likely reason. If I have to do according to my calculations. So anyway, Patrick DeWitt also wrote this Under Major Domo Minor. Patrick DeWitt also wrote a book called Help Yourself, Help Yourself. It's like this tiny little self-published chapbook. It was funny. I called this... So they had it in stock at this place, supposedly, this store. And I emailed back and forth with this store a couple times, and it was like this, you know, L.A. boutique store, and it was horrible. Like, they were such assholes about it and just wouldn't even, like, help me out at all. And then I emailed with Patrick DeWitt's brother, who was, I guess, involved in placing it in the store or something like that. Nicest dude ever. Got me a copy of it and everything. It was really cool. It was funny because I was just like, see, this store is like fucking assholes. But then you talk to someone else who's nice and you're like, oh yeah, like what I was asking wasn't crazy. I was like, hey, I think you guys might have a thing and I would like to purchase that thing. And you're a store. What do you say? And they're like, go fuck yourself, moron. Not doing it. Which doesn't make sense to me, but okay. So anyway, Under Major Domo Minor. So it's kind of a set in a I don't know. Let's call it World War I-ish time, maybe a little before that even, because I think it was I'm not good at history or geography, which is something that, you know, definitely limits my scope of things, because like historical novels are not interesting to me because I don't understand the history most of the time anyway. So then when you lay something fictional on top, I don't even know what's fake and what's real. And, you know, I'm the guy who would be reading a, you know, fiction version of, like, the post-Civil War, the Reconstruction period. And, you know, it ends with Lincoln going, like, I'm off to the theater, wink. And I'd be like, what? I know that's supposed to mean something, but I don't know what. And then I'd have to look it up and be like, oh, he got shotted. Well, now I know. You know, I'm just that much of an idiot. So anyway, it takes place in old-timey times. Let's say post-locomotive, pre-automobile. How about that? And this guy kind of goes to an old castle to sort of serve as a servant, basically. And it's got this great Patrick DeWitt stuff in it. Like, he has this way of doing these very unlikable characters. which is something I thought is, it's always funny with his work because you'll read people's reviews of it and be like, I didn't like any of the characters. And it makes me crazy when someone says that in a review where they're like, I didn't like any of the characters, like, as people or something. Because it's sort of like, hey, listen, I don't know if I like, I don't know if I like the guy who's, like, coming to my house to fix the tile. But if he does a great job and he charges me a reasonable amount, like, it doesn't matter to me if he's like, oh, he seems like a real nice guy, you know what I mean? Like, I don't care. What do I care? And sort of the same in books. I think it's funny that people put so much stock in likability. And, you know, it's like, oh, this is a good guy that I would hang out with. It's sort of like what they do with presidents, right? Oh, I'd like to have a beer with that guy. And I'm sort of like, who cares? Like, I mean, you know, I've said good and bad things about candidates, and I'll say this about Hillary, like, Even if she had a reputation for being, like, a ruthless bitch, I don't know if that's such a bad thing for, like, a world leader. You know what I mean? If behind closed doors she's kind of like, hey, man, she's going to go into this negotiation and get what she wants, and it's not going to be pleasant for the other people, I'd be like, I mean, I don't know if that's not what I want as president. I don't know if that's exactly who I want as president, right? I mean, come on. What do you want? You want someone who's like, oh, well, you know, the guy from North Korea came over and they had a really nice time together and nothing got solved. Eh. I mean, I'm not dying for that way. I'm not looking for that necessarily. So anyway, his books always have these unlikable characters in it. And it's like, he's got a new one coming out later this year. And I saw someone had written a review, and they're just like, I just couldn't connect with any of the characters. They were so unlikable. And I'm like, yeah, that's what this guy does every time. Like, that's kind of his thing, and something that I personally really like. I mean, I don't know why people want that all the time. And it's just like, I feel like unlikable characters are not as prevalent as you know, heroic characters. This comes up a lot in, I think, like, literature for teenagers. Like, I really struggle with that because it seems like every character is basically a minor superhero, at least. You know, if they're, like, supposed to be in high school and stuff, they're, like, a low-level superhero in terms of morality and stuff. And in terms of, you know, I don't know, they always make good choices, they're always good looking, they're always this, they're always that, and you're just like, oh god, okay. Well, I'm so sorry that it's so hard to be so perfect. It's like, it seems like half the books for teenagers want to send the message of, you know, it's not easy being perfect. Which I'm like, I know that, like, I wouldn't pretend it's like, ugh, being perfect is like, you know, your ticket to ride. But at the same time, I'm like, I mean, I don't think I'm as interested in hearing about how it's not easy to be perfect. It doesn't seem like a high interest topic to me. I mean, who is that for? Who's the audience? The perfect? I really want to make sure there's a novel out there for people who are perfect, because I don't feel like they've been represented in every comic book ever written. The story is funny too. He's got like a very dark sense of humor. You know, like in his books, life, human and animal, has very little value. Characters die frequently or die horribly or die in ways where it's like they die off screen, as I like to say, even though I know it's not a movie. But they die off screen because it's not important. Their death's not really important to the story. And I just think that's so interesting because you don't really see that a lot. You know, if someone's got a death scene, everyone wants to show it and milk it. And also, if someone dies off screen, that's kind of our, like, I think we've been conditioned in narrative to think, like, if I don't see the person die, I don't see their body, they're probably still alive. In his books, it's different. It's just much more realistic. Also, the way that other people sort of encounter death is really different. I mean, other humans basically don't know how to deal with death and rarely react to it appropriately, or what I would say is, you know, someone dies, someone doesn't always like, well, the right thing to do is bury them. You know what I mean? Sometimes they're just like, well, that guy's dead. That's not exactly what I wanted. And that's all there is to it. So I like that. I like that it's a different take on this stuff. You know, I like that it's... I enjoy that they're very unique. And they're different from each other, his books. And this one's no exception. So, dumb of me to wait so long to read it. Recommend it.
I also read a book called The Book of Ralph, which started fucking incredible.
There's a guy listening to Freebird on his motorcycle on one of those where it's like the music is blasting outside, you know what I mean? Like, it's just got to be so loud so you can hear it while you're on the motorcycle, and that means it's got to be so loud that everyone in the world can hear it. Oh, God. It's like, motorcycle riding is like one of the most fun things I ever did. And other motorcyclists are like one of my most hated people. I just like hate everyone who rides a motorcycle. They all just seem like dicks. As someone who did it, I'm like, they all just kind of act like dicks. You know, we talked about bikes before, now motorcycles. I guess maybe two-wheel conveyance is just not... Segway, people don't like those people. Razor scooters, I can't believe that the Razor scooter is still like a thing. Like, I would have thought that would have gone out with like the pogo ball or something like that, and people would just, it's kind of a novelty. You still see people on them all the time. And like, I live close to a college campus, you'll see people using that as like legit transportation between classes. Like the longboard, which I also wish would go out of style. The longboard is like the dumbest thing because I think people get on it and don't really know how to do it, and then that becomes everyone's problem because they're like careening down a sidewalk and they can't stop. Because it's like, if you're going to be on a vehicle of some kind or a wheeled conveyance, what's your stopping distance here? Because on a longboard it seems like, I don't know, infinite, forever. Depends if there's like sand nearby, I guess. Luckily I go onto a campus that has a pillow factory on it, you know, as a training opportunity. It's great. Like, we have students who study embroidery, so they do that. We have a business student, so they run the, you know, this asinine scenario where it makes sense to ride a longboard. That's how far you have to go. But anyway, Book of Ralph started hilarious. It's like a young kid growing up in like Chicago suburb, and I'm trying to tell you, like,
okay, so Ralph isn't the main character. He's not our narrator. He's like our narrator's buddy, and Ralph is a fuck up.
You know, he's failed a couple grades and shit. And one of the things Ralph comes up with in the book is he finds this book that's like about the mob, and he tears a sheet out of the book because it reprinted a page that the mob put out, which was like, here's what we'll charge to do different things to people. So like, you want us to go you know, punch someone in black in their eye, that's $2. You want us to break their nose, that's $4, you know, and the prices go all the way up to killing somebody. And so like, Ralph takes this and is like, I'm gonna start this as my new business. And so you know, and the other kid's like, it's only $2 to give someone a black eye, like, that doesn't seem like a lot. And Ralph's like, that's the whole thing, it's, you know, 1978 service at 1888 prices or something like that. So then he gets a hit on this kid that they go to school with, and like, these adults pay this Ralph to bite the ear off this kid. And so he's like stalking the kid for a couple weeks because he wants the money. So he's thinking about it, but he's like, I want to make sure that this kid's actually up to something, because it doesn't seem like he's up to anything.
And you know, they see this kid and you,
Christ. You start feeling bad for this kid because they follow him around and this kid's like real into Star Wars trading cards or something. And he's like meets this other kid at a culvert to trade Star Wars cards with him, you know, because it was like a nerdy thing to do. So you'd, you know, just do it at school. And he's always like flipping through his Star Wars cards by himself. And so he's a total nerd and they can't figure out what he would have done to anybody and so on. And then it turns out, you know, that this kid's dad goes missing. And it turns out the kid's dad has the exact same name as the kid. And so he owed people money. He had like a bunch of gambling debts and stuff. And gets killed.
And so, you know, Ralph was hired to like attack the dad, not the kid. But he didn't know that because he's kind of an idiot and a fuck up.
Here you go. There's another great part where the narrator, his grandma, he comes home, his grandma's at home. And the grandma's sitting in a chair with no shoes on. And he's like, hey, grandma. And the dad's like, don't talk to her. She's grounded and can't talk. You know, and the grandma, like, zips up her lips. So it turns out the grandma was pulling this scam where she'd go to, like, Goodwill, buy a cheap, shitty pair of shoes. Then she'd go into a nice shoe store, try on a pair of nice shoes, and then just walk out with them and leave her other shoes behind.
And, you know, the shoe store got wise to the whole thing, and they busted her.
So then she's at their house because she had to pay bail, and the dad's, like, flipping out because he's like, I can't believe my mom's getting arrested for this, and, like, what the fuck? And Ralph, this kid tells Ralph about it, and Ralph has, like, total respect for the grandma. So then the grandma dies, like, 2 days later. Just kind of happens. And Ralph is like, well, you know what happened, right? And the kid's like, what are you talking about? And, you know, Ralph's like, oh, Hank, so naive. He's like, do you think it's really a coincidence that your grandma just got busted by all these guys and now she's dead? And the Hank kid's like, what do you mean? You know, and he's like, I'll spell it out for you. They conspired to kill your grandma. Like, you know that's what happened. And this kid's like, okay, you know, but ultimately, the kid ends up going to the mall or whatever to get clothes for the funeral, and one of the stops is at the shoe store. So then he starts saying this shit with his mom there because they have to get him fancy shoes, and the shoe store guy is like, oh, you know, this is a nice suit that you bought. What's the occasion or something? And they're like, oh, it's a funeral. And he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. And the kid's like, yeah, my grandma died. Her name is such and such. Maybe it rings a bell. And the guy's like, no, I'm sorry, it doesn't. He's like, oh, okay. And then him and the mom are talking, and the kid breaks in and says something like, you know, we suspect that she might have been murdered. And the guy's like, murdered? And of course the mom is like, oh, Jesus fucking Christ, like, shut up, Hank. And, you know, the kid later too is like, yeah, she fell in with a bad crowd. You know, her name is this, maybe you know it. And it's just like, the scene is hilarious because he's just talking with this guy, and like, the kid thinks he's so smart and being so sly about it, and obviously the shoe store guy knows nothing about it. And the mom is just like, what the fuck? What the fuck was that? When you told that guy, we suspect foul play and grandma's death. We do not suspect foul play and grandma's death at all. Like, that is just a crazy thing you made up. So it's good. The reason I told you so much about it, though, is, like, I think the first third of it was great. Like, it was all stuff like that. It was super funny and whatever. And then the last two thirds, and especially the last third, is a lot more, like, maudlin and serious and not nearly as fun. And it just kind of didn't do it for me. You know, I think the thing is that, like, a book like the first part of the Book of Ralph is this sort of absurd comedy, and it's like real comedy. I mean, sometimes when people talk about comedy in books, they're like, oh, you mean like Kafka? And I'm like, no, I don't mean like Kafka. I don't mean just something unusual. And it's like, oh, how funny is that? You know, it's, oh, it's this very dry humor. I mean something actually funny that elicits laughter, not, oh, that's ironic, isn't it? So I think that the Book of Ralph started out as something that was genuinely funny. And I think it could have gotten to a, you know, a heartfelt place, but
it wasn't, I think it maybe overreached
on that aspect, and therefore wasn't as good as it could have been. Gaman. I wrote on my hand the things I've read, and now I'm like, Gaman? Goman? Gurman? Oh, Gamma. I'm reading a play called The Effects of Gamma Radiation on Man in the Moon Marigolds. This is for class, because Chuck keeps recommending it. I haven't really seen it happen yet, but it must be towards the end. But it's a lesson about big voice and little voice, so that's something we talk about in class. It's kind of hard to totally get, but most things are written in a combination of what we call big voice and little voice. Big voice is like narration or, looking back at it now, I know what happened. So, Wonder Years. The narration is big voice. It just sort of steps outside the story and tells what's happening and tells what happened and how everyone felt and so on and so forth. Little voice is like the moment to moment. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. This is also kind of related to the horizontal and the vertical, I guess. The horizontal is like, this happened, this happened, this happened. The vertical is then you kind of, in the moment, the person is saying something, maybe outside of time, or saying how they felt about something. You know, this happened, and I started feeling this way. That's when it goes a little vertical, right? And so big voice, little voice is like that. The big voice is sort of the almost narration authority in the story, and the little voice is like, this was happening, I felt this, so on and so forth. So, you know, and these are just different textures you can have in your story. And so this play is kind of supposed to do that. I don't really recommend reading plays for the most part.
It's kind of it's hard to read a play.
You know, you don't see any setting. The descriptions of, like, the physical action is just so brief. And there's nothing to it. I mean, you gotta assume that if someone was doing this on the stage, they would put more into it. You know what I mean? This one has drawings of the setting, which kind of help. But overall, it's just all dialogue. And I think that's a tough way to absorb a story. So, we got that. I'm not quite done with that, but almost. I'm reading Flannery O'Connor short stories. That's also for class, and also I just happen to have that. That's like an 800-page book, though. So I'm kind of feeling like, I don't know, should I keep going with this or not? Because on the one hand, if I got that off the shelf, that'd be pretty great. On the other hand, it's a pretty solid book, so maybe I would keep it. But on the other hand, it's probably something I can get a nicer edition of if I wanted to down the road. She writes pretty good short stories. I like that she goes crazy. You know, a lot of times shit happens that you're like, a lot of people die. Okay, one of the better ones, I think it's called The Life You Save May Be Your Own. I think that was this one. That's definitely one of her titles, but basically it's like quite a while ago in the South. This guy comes rambling along, and he's kind of a handyman. But he's like missing a leg or missing an arm and part of a leg or something. And so he starts working for this woman who has a daughter, and the daughter is like disabled. I mean, she's pleasant, but you know, doesn't really have agency, I guess I would say. Hadn't really spoken at all, etc. And so this guy comes along and he starts, you know, doing some handyman work and stuff. And the mom, you know, at the beginning is talking about how, like, she would never let her daughter marry because she wouldn't want her to be taken away from, you know, where they live and each other. But then she starts seeing the guy and the daughter interact a little. And she's like, I don't know, this guy seems all right. And so then she kind of makes this proposal to him of, you know, hey, listen, you're missing an arm and part of a leg. You're never going to find a pleasant, nice woman, and you're always talking about how, you know, all these women you meet are not nice and they're impure and so on and so forth.
Why don't you just marry my daughter? And I'll give you, you know, there's this car they had at the bar, and she's like, I'll let you have the car.
and I'll give you, like, some cash. Because he basically says, like, well, I'd need a few days off and, like, $17 for a honeymoon, you know? She's like, I'll give you whatever. They have a negotiation. So they take off on this honeymoon. And, you know, he's with this disabled daughter who's, like, very pretty. But, you know, there's nothing upstairs. And they go, and it ends up there at, like, a diner. And she falls asleep on the diner, you know, on the counter. And he orders her some food and then tells the person, like, just give it to her when she wakes up. And then he takes off and just is going away. And so he's, like, a few hours away from where the mom was. And he's taken this girl out a few hours from where she lives. There's basically no chance of her getting home, as far as I can tell. And, I mean, what a fucked up thing to do, right? But at the same time, an interesting choice for a story. I mean, like, something happened in that story. That's for goddamn sure. No one can say that in a Flannery O'Connor story nothing happened, because something always happens. So there you go. I read of Mice and Men. This is a classic example of a novel that I would say is, like, totally ruined by reading it in school, and that you should read it when you're 34 and taking a writing class. Because then you can kind of appreciate it. You can see what's good about it and what's bad about it. But overall be like, you know, this is pretty solid. And, like, I respect what's happening here. But when you're in, like, 8th grade, you don't... No, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work for 8th graders. I mean, I really think it's about the message of that book. You know, even in the title, right? Best Laid Plans of Mice and Men is basically, like... You can make all these great plans, you can be a good person, you can do the right things, and you probably still won't be anything special and won't be any different from anyone else, and will end up doing kind of the same thing. And I think that's a message that in 8th grade you're not ready to hear. Because you kind of feel, I think most 8th graders feel kind of like they are different and unique and special, and they're not. Now, I don't just... There's a car who's going into an imaginary right lane that doesn't exist. I don't know. I think that when you're in 8th grade, you just don't... You don't know that. And I don't mean you're not special in the way of, like, there's nothing special about you. You might as well give up. What I'm saying is you're not just going to, you know, get out of this one-horse town because you really want to. And you're not gonna just be different. Like, you might feel really different, you might act differently, but you're not just gonna sort of... The world is not gonna turn around and recognize that you're this special individual. Like, it's not gonna work that way. And I think that's sort of what happens in the book, the message that's reinforced time and again. And I just don't think it's, like, the right message for an 8th grader. Not because I don't think they can handle it, but because I just don't think you're interested in that message in, like, 8th grade. I mean, I don't think it resonates. That's what I should say. When you're 34 and you've realized that you not only have not achieved your dream, but you're not even really sure what you would call your dream, and when you're also like, I don't know anyone personally who I would say has achieved their dream. I wouldn't use that lofty language with anyone I know. You start feeling like maybe nobody does this. Like, maybe this isn't a way in which anyone succeeds ever. Well, there you go. Isn't that a nice wrap-up for this? No one succeeds ever. I've been Pete. All right. Well, regardless of whether or not, I guess we'll see you next time.